Hi everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Software Crafts podcast. My name is João, and today with us we have Liz Keogh. Liz is a lean, agile, and Knevin consultant. She has roots in the BDD community, and as she told me enough, she will be back to development work soon. Hi Liz, thanks to be with us today.
Hi Anne, cool. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. So moving to the pattern, today is not an heuristic, it's a pattern. And the pattern, it's a very simple one, but I believe that will lead us to lots of discussion. The pattern is ongoing education. What is your experience with this pattern?
So I'm not totally familiar with the cloud native thing. I dropped out of development shortly before cloud became a big deal. I did do some experimenting with it. I've obviously worked with a lot of organizations that are either transitioning to the cloud, startups that started in the cloud. I guess that's what you call cloud native. Lots of organizations with hybrid stuff going on, you know, so they've got part of an application still on servers and they're gradually moving everything over. Lots of strangle patterns and things like that happening. The thing that really interested me was that when I looked at it, it says ongoing education, and I couldn't find anything really specific about it that was specific to cloud native. It looks like a fairly generic pattern that you could apply to any kind of new technology that you wanted to adopt. So from that perspective, I can definitely share some insights. You mentioned when we were chatting earlier, my background in behavior-driven development. That's been a really interesting thing to teach to people. I looked at some of the, because I think there's always stuff that's related to education. So to get people educated, you have to know other people. And I saw there were patterns around evangelists. There were patterns around tribes. The one thing that I saw was missing, which I really, really think is important, and maybe it's in one of the other sections that I didn't get a chance to look at, was connecting yourself to the external community. So external to the organizations. That's really the only way to bring in expertise from that your organization does not have, where that expertise exists. So, for instance, when we were teaching BDD, it was usually as an external person who's come in to teach people at a conference or at a meetup. It was always people from outside the organization sharing their insights with people inside. And I think if you've got an organization which has experts already, that's great. But if it's new to you, if it's something where you're having to use patterns because it's not a straightforward thing for you, then probably you want to be looking outside too.
This is a very interesting one, right? Connect with communities. And in my head pops up two things that I think that you refer in a formal way and informal way. And I'm going to explain. So informal way, meetups, right? And people that gather together around the topic, discuss something or do a workshop. And then there is the other one, formal, okay, bring the experts inside of the company to give training. Do you see differences when the companies adopt one way or the other with the rate of picking up a new topic or a new technology? Or do you see best results when they blend both approaches?
So I think I see the best results when companies are prepared to invest in learning. It does send a really good signal to bring trainers in to teach something, just because it says we're willing to pay for this. This is important to us. But equally, you've got to have people volunteering. You can't have people. I've been to places where people have been forced to attend my workshop, and the difference in approach is just phenomenal. There's a lady called Marion Willicke who put me on to a method for measuring engagement in workshop, and it's called Bloom's Effective Taxonomy. It's got these different levels, but it basically starts at level zero is it's listening, or level one is listening. right? Just respectfully. Level two is asking questions and being interactive. Level three is inviting others to come along. Level four is creating a stuff yourself and teaching it. So you can see what levels people are engaged at when you come into these spaces. I have seen people fail that first level. They just do not want to be there. And it's so unfortunate because it's a waste of time for everybody when that happens. You know, I'd rather those people just don't come to the workshop, go to a different workshop, one that interests you. Because everybody's capable of learning. Everybody is interested in something. I don't mind if it's not my thing people are interested in. So I think forcing this stuff always results in a backfire effect, which is an emotional response to being presented with data or information, like you're going to go to this training course. And when you have that backfire, when you have that emotional response, what I usually see is that people will strengthen their arguments for why they don't have to do it or why it's not right for them. And at that point, you've now made it even harder for them to learn, even harder for them to try things out. So when I encounter that pushback, when I encounter that backfire effect, I just back off. You know, try something else. So if people don't want to learn BDD or people don't want to learn cloud native, maybe they want to learn how build pipeline works. Maybe they want to, we had one situation where they didn't want to learn BDD, but they were prepared to get a monitor up at the end of the table that showed the status of the build. That was actually a lady who was training as an agile coach had that idea. And within a month or so, there was more interest in BDD because they could see their build pipeline was red. And the tests were a bit flaky and they were failing and they didn't really know about the test pyramid. So I think finding the people who want to learn is the first step. Connecting them to the people they can learn from, however you do it, is the second. And you mentioned that I was very into complexity. That connection of people to other people is something Dave Snowden, he's the guy who created the Kinevin framework, he talks about that an awful lot. Social network stimulation.
Yeah. So it's very interesting. And thanks also to bring the Bloom's engaging taxonomy. It's a thing that in our workshops, we also use, right, usually the show and tell, but also I feel you when you talk about resistance, and especially I also had people try to sabotage in a form that arrive later or just disappear in the middle of the workshops. Or so it's very interesting, and in my opinion tells a lot also about the organization itself rather than the topic to learn. So common stories there. And what I like now, you did this for me, the bridge, right? You start talking about Kinevin. From what I know from Kinevin, and there are five domains, right? And mostly in software, we are between complex and complicated areas, right? If we think
unless
about...
Unless you got production bugs, yes.
that becomes chaotic and the system goes down. If we have an organization that mostly operates on complex and complicated domains, do you recommend to have different types of education or learnings if you are part of the organization in one domain or part of the organization in the other one? Or how do you connect learning there?
So I think it's not a matter of, you know, part of the organization. It's software development's always driven by complexity. So everybody always has a little bit of complexity. Even if you're a supplier working on the bits that some organization thinks are really predictable and they've outsourced them to you, you've still not worked with that stuff with that organization before. You've still got to get feedback. There's still going to be human issues. You're still going to misunderstand. So I think everybody works with both complexity and complicatedness. Having said that, with respect to this pattern, for anyone not familiar with Kinevin, complex means it's emergent and you can tell how it works with hindsight. Complicated stuff, it's predictable. You can get expertise on it who knows what the outcome should look like. So I can see there are little things there like hackathons. there's a pattern from the apprenticeship patterns called breakable toy. And it means to get something that's safe to fail, because you're not trying something out for the first time in your production environment with your production code. So I really like code carters and tutorials and things like that from that perspective, because the outcome is predictable. So you can tell if you've done it right. And it takes away some of that complexity and focuses the complexity back on the learning, the new thing that you're picking up and the new thing you're trying to emerge for yourself. So from that perspective, yeah, if I wanted to do something educational, I would tend to pick a complicated problem. Except in the realm of BDD, because BDD is all itself about learning. So we tend to try and pick a problem that isn't obvious, that isn't easy to solve, and actually has to involve some conversation. Since that's also the bit of BDD that I think lots of people miss out as well. So maybe it could be a problem that's tricky enough that it requires a little bit of ingenuity to solve, but does have some outcome where you can at least say, oh, that looks good. That I like what I just did there. And you know what good looks like.
Yeah, very interesting. Although you approached this angle, and I also can relate to you, although I'm more in the DDD community. A few years back, myself and Kenny, we were in London with a mini-series of testing community with our workshop. And because they were basically testers, they figured out all of the traps that we have there that usually developers go into, because they had this mindset, we're into the BDD, they just quickly pick up all the traps. So it's also very interesting to see, you know, the training and how people are exposed to get this, right?
I love testers. Love testers. One of the things that we look for in complexity is what we're doing, safe to fail. And they will think of the ways it's going to fail that we haven't thought of, you know, really, even if it's not code.
Exactly. The joke that the tester tests all the bar, but then the client comes and asks to go to the toilet. So they didn't ask different types of beers, right? So is this the how things change? And I think that this is connected to one thing that Kent Beck said at DDD Europe 2 years ago. That was, every time that software reaches to production, changes itself, because people figure out different ways to use the software. And that also, I think, that shows us that, as you stress, most of the software, or it's on the complex domain, it's emergent. We put something, we do some assumptions, and then people find different usage for it. So it's very, very interesting, the industry that we work. Getting back a bit in between learning workshops and Knevin, one of the things that I'm really fan is the sense-making exercises. Did you ever use sense-making exercises in the workshops to make visible some patterns that are latent in your organizations?
Yeah, so I've actually done some work with clients with SenseMaker itself, which is an absolutely lovely tool. So it uses dyads and triads, which is where you get a triangle and you have to, and each of the corners of the triangle is marked, or a line, and either end of the line is marked. And we always try to make it tricky to work out where you should be putting your marker in that triangle or on that line. So to give an example, I've actually used triads and dyads in one of my workshops. I'm trying to remember what I put in it. I think it was something like, I want to learn the theory and how to apply this in different contexts. I want to practice, and I want it to work for me in my context right now. You know, so that was one of the triangles. And then that lets me see where people want to put their problem. You know, and it was really interesting, because if you talk to people in the workshop, they might, I usually get this thing, we need it to work, we need it to be practical. But when you actually ask, what do you want to learn? The counters were very, very much in the, we want to the theory corner. We want to be able to apply it in different contexts. So they're aware that their context is going to change. And it's not enough just to have the solutions for the context they're in right now. They also want to explore around the problem. I had one dyad that said, I said, how do you want to experience this workshop? I really like play. I really like when it's taken seriously. You know, I like play. I like it to be serious. And again, it was a group where the previous day I had had somebody tell me, quite unkindly, in fact, that I was too playful. And he said it was excruciating. But when I actually checked, you know, they were mostly in the middle. And there was one person who was definitely all the way over the play side with me. So it's a really fun way of seeing the culture at work. And SenseMaker, Dave Snowden's used that an awful lot, and Cognitive Edge have used that an awful lot for understanding the culture, or not understanding it, but seeing what shifts it, because you can't really understand culture. It's the whole point of complexity. There's too many contexts to get your head around. So you can never really understand cause and effect until you've made the cause and seen the effect, always in retrospect.
Yep. So, and this is brilliant, right? The using these sense-making exercises to check what people really want beyond their words, right? So it's amazing.
And yeah, it's not even what people want. It's what works. What works.
Also as well, it's a good one. And since you are a consultant and you have Lean, Agile, and Knevin under your belt, do you have a feeling that organizations are adopting more sense-making exercises to have a more adaptive culture, let's say, right? A more resilient culture where they are able to check where different groups of people are or what are the preferences? Or do you think that we still have a long way to go until, for instance, just sense-making puts the boots on the ground, let's say?
I think we have a long way to go. Honestly, I've been in a lot of big Agile transformations now, and I've seen Knevin in every single one of the decks. And yet the most common thing I see is people trying to make their sprints predictable. Like you've got Knevin in your Agile deck, and yet you're measuring how predictable your teams are. It's a great way to stamp out all your innovation. You know, if you want teams to only do the things that they can actually estimate accurately. It means they've done it before. Otherwise, they can't estimate it, which means that they're now doing it again. It's I think that human craving for predictability isn't going away anytime soon. It's extremely prevalent in management layers. And the more management layers you have, the more likely I think you are to have it. It's a really hard thing to shift. Is that mindset, if you can't have the control you think you can, you can't have the control you want. And I've had some success, certainly with smaller companies, 80, 100 people. Up to about that point, I think the leadership are still, they're aware that emergency is happening, they're aware that culture is changing, they're aware that their product's moving across that Wardley map and becoming more stable, and now people's mortgages depend on their job, you know. So I think that they tend to be open to learning. But when you're dealing with, for instance, a big bank with tens of thousands of people in IT, let alone the rest of the bank, you know, trying to get complexity understood, it just doesn't happen. I take what wins I can at the team level. So we have a lot of conversations about constraints and the nature of constraints, whether things are hard and fast constraints, that what Dave Snowden calls governing constraints, and then enabling constraints are more heuristics and guidelines. So they're things which have some permeability, and you can get out of them if you need to. So a lot of what I do is help people understand whether something really is a hard and fast constraint and whether it ought to be. And a lot of the time you find these gates, these rigid rules around things, and they were created for some exceptional case that only happened once, 3 years ago. And now nobody ever wants that to happen again. It's like, okay, can we make some holes in this? Can we make this permeable? And do we have to follow that? I think that's something where the cloud native patterns people might find that really interesting, because again, you're talking about patterns and heuristics. As soon as those become hard and fast rules, and you start doing things like mandate it in the pull requests and put tools around it to enforce it so that people can't use human judgment to get around it, at that point, it stops being enabling. And I see people fighting to get through those kind of constraints. When you're learning, particularly, you're going to get some of that stuff wrong and have to tidy up afterwards. And as long as it's safe to fail, I think that's okay. So you don't need, I think you don't need as many hard and fast rules as you do safety nets.
Definitely, definitely. And I relate to that. So in my previous life, before I moved to consultancy, I worked with central banks. So I actually know what central banks ask to banks. And now as a consultant, I was involved in transformations on DevOps side. And they, as you refer, had all of these processes. And every time they said, oh, because central bank wanted this. And I was, this is not what central bank ask you, because I know what they ask you. It's two things, traceability and accountability. It's just two things that they want to know, how the money is flowing and who put that code in production. They just want to know. They are not imposing you this list of 200 rules that no one can move. And it's very interesting that you had a similar experience. And connecting education to management, right? Because these, it's also, as we started, right, we try to be predictable. That is a thing that our brain tries to be. You know, I recognize these patterns. I want to be predictable because I'm afraid of this chaos. It's, well, we are hardwired like that. I have the feeling that when people go to management, they forget about the past, or they are not learning enough to be on those positions, right? Because if they were software engineers, testers, whatever, that, you know, went to the management positions, I quite often find that they forget the pain that they had when they were in teams. And sometimes the education is not continual at those levels.
Right. So the Peter principle is everybody gets promoted to the level of their incompetence, right? And that's always going to happen because you've never done the job before. There's learning that you're going to have to do. I think technical managers have a particularly hard time because having come from a technical place where there is a certain level of certainty, your code behaves exactly the way you coded it. Moving to a more people-focused role can be really hard. That was another thing that I actually saw in that pattern, the ongoing education pattern. There doesn't seem to be a recognition of the need for internal trainers. So if you're not getting your trainers from outside, they have to be inside. And learning to coach and train people is a bunch of skills and techniques in and of itself. So if you're not, if you don't have those trainers internally, you're going to have to teach the trainers, which means doing trainer-trainer courses and you know, sending people out to go meet other people who train and learn from other trainers. And again, most of my knowledge has come from, again, people like Marion Willicke. I did do Sharon L. Bowman's Training from the Back of the Room course. I read a lot of books. I spoke to a lot of other experienced trainers. And that was how I adopted my techniques. And I'm still not perfect. Still make huge numbers of mistakes where training courses are concerned. But you've got to, again, you're learning, you've got to start somewhere. I think there was another pattern which underpins all of this, both for the trainers and the people on the courses. If you're new to taking on this kind of education, effort, and you can win, but want you to succeed. Those courses where I've been in there and people just haven't wanted to be there and they've played up, they've caused chaos, they've behaved really badly in some situations, reflect it back to the room. I had was in one meeting where somebody literally took a phone call in the middle of the training, in the middle of the room. How does that even happen? You're not a child. You know to go outside with that stuff. I mean, I don't, again, backfire effect. I don't mandate that people turn their phone off. I just let them know, you know, you're an adult, behave appropriately. You know if the phone call is important. You know if your emails are important. I would love you to pay attention, but I understand, especially working with that CXO layer. If you ever work with CXO layers, trying to get them off their phones, it's just impossible. I think that having that psychological safety, I think making it okay for people to try things out, to be idiots, to ask a stupid question, that's so important. I've actually run a workshop with management where I got them to think about times they were unsafe and what would make them feel safe, and think about times they were safe and what enabled them to ask those stupid questions without feeling like an idiot. What did people say? And you watch them change their behavior when they reflect on how they were made to feel safe before they became managers, you know, and they'll start saying, please do ask questions, even if it's just, what's this acronym? You know, you're new here, you're new to this, there's no stupid questions. And that can make people feel so much more welcome when they're new to a topic.
Definitely, definitely. I can see that. So it's the principle of stay open and curious, right? If that is there, will help. And also connecting all of these, having conversations. And I actually was a few weeks back in the Ben Mosier live stream with Steve Pereira. And we were talking about being task focused. That is where pretty much even some of the agile methodologies comes. Okay, let's have these tasks and have the boundaries versus be flow focus, right? So the idea of lean, the idea of DevOps, the idea of how it's emerging more and more value stream management, which is very interesting, right? Because one of the things that you were talking was enabling flow, at least as I understood. If you are a company that don't want to use external trainers, you need to train your own workforce just to do that. So we literally are creating an enabling team. If we talk about in team topologies terminology, you are creating an enabling team to enable the flow in the organization. And I'm just putting this out there because a few minutes back, you also talked about worldly maps and components giving back and forth. I think that...
Yeah, I did.
This is what it's about. It's enabling the flow. It's not, let's cram as many work we have on this sprint and try to be predictable, but what is the flow? And by the way, the flow is moving because our product is successful, so more people want to use the product in a different way. So let's adapt. I do think that this can be the concept for next year. How do you feel about that?
I think that if I could give three hints and tips to just about every team or organization department that thinks it's agile and is doing Scrum by the book as the book was a couple of years back. The number one is be really, really clear about priorities. What are the team trying to achieve? How they know they've achieved it? You know, what's the highest priority thing to do, to be working on? And I see too many organizations where there's a team, they've got three completely different things which are independently shippable they're trying to get done, and they're trying to schedule production bugs in amongst that. So be really clear, get them focused on one thing at once, and if you have to interrupt it for production issues, so be it. You know, obviously try and minimize those. The second one is to start treating those sprint dates like they're dates. You don't hold things in sprint 15 because they're very nearly finished when it's sprint 16 now. Just move it over. It's fine to move things over. Stop worrying about flowing things over. You're going to make discoveries. It's going to happen. Be okay with that and allow that to guide you. I think a lot of the antipassants I see are people really worrying about how much they can get done and the sprint failure. The Scrum Guides actually removed the word commitment. It's not in there anymore. It talks about committing to a sprint goal, but it doesn't talk about committing to the work you brought into the sprint. And that's what I think causes this task focus, because everybody looks at it and goes, do I have enough to do in this sprint with the skills that I have? Now, of course, if a lot of your work is cloud native and you don't have the skills, now you're working on something that might not be needed for another 4 weeks, or you might not be needed at all. It might turn out that, you know, the cloud bit of that or the front end bit of that isn't going to get done. So being able to focus as a team on the most important thing to do. So again, back to the prioritization. Can you do that as a team? And if you can't, can you learn the skills so that you can do that as a team? Who do you pick them up off? Can you go pair with the person who does know? So again, it brings us back to this education. I said I was going to end up talking about skills liquidity at some point, right? It's what Chris Matz calls the ability to get hold of skills whenever you need them. And you get it by relentlessly focusing on whatever the highest priority thing to do is and enabling people to educate either themselves or get the training they need or pair program, whatever it is, to get the skills if they don't have them. So that's the second thing is your sprint dates. And then the third thing is within that, focus on the stuff you have the least expertise about. What's newest to you? What's most likely to go horribly, horribly wrong? How can you focus on that first? It's often to do with the outcome of the thing you're working on. So Chris Matz again says, start with the outcome. If you've got a report you're trying to generate, what does it look like? Can you get it working on one cloud instance first? You know, you've got one user that they're logged in already. What have they logged in for? It only works for 1 month. So just getting it working and then working back from that and adding more and more behavior until what you've got is working, scalable, all the rest of it. And if scalable and in the cloud is the thing you know least about, get Hello World up there as your first pass.
Yeah. You know? So I think this is a wonderful way to go to the end of this episode. So thanks for these tips and connecting everything back, right? Because we covered lots of ground today. And talking about covering lots of ground, my final question is, what are the resources that you recommend to our audience? Books, podcasts, blogs, whatever that can help people continue on this learning journey.
So you mentioned Wardley Mapping. Simon Wardley's book is free. He's got a video called Crossing the River by Feeling the Stones. You can find that. There's a couple of instances of that from different conferences. Really great speaker, lots of fun to watch. The bit where he turns the architecture diagram into Elvish is always my favourite. I really love Chris Matz's graphic novel, Commitment. Chris Matz and Olaf Marson produced it with Chris Geary as the artist. I'm actually in it. I crop up on page 76, so don't be surprised when you see me say hi. It's a very easy read because it's a graphic novel. It only takes a couple of hours to get through, and it'll teach you all the lovely real options, skills, liquidity stuff that plays so nicely with complexity. The Kinevin body of knowledge, that's something which has completely changed the way I live my life. So I cannot recommend that strongly enough. I've got an introduction called Kinevin for Everybody, Kinevin for Everyone. It's on the right-hand side of my blog. There's some original articles by Dave Snowden. He's got lots and lots of blog posts. I will warn that it's a rabbit hole. Once you think you understand the basic diagram, and then you start going into the intricacies of what complexity really means, and you start appreciating things like exaptation and how Agile manages out innovation and all the other amazing things that I've learned in over more than 10 years now. There is still so much to learn, and I'm still enjoying that learning journey so much as well. So get started on that journey as soon as you can, because there's plenty in there and it's really rich and it affects almost every single instance of your daily life and how you go about getting work done.
Okay, thanks very much. I will make sure that these resources are on the description of the episode. And once again, thanks for your time and being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
No problem. You can follow us on Twitter at @scraftspodcast. Visit our webpage, softwarecraftspodcast.com, and visit our page on LinkedIn. Hope to see you next week.